I'm retired NYPD Detective Vic Ferrari, and welcome to NYPD Through the Looking, where you'll get unique insight into the New York City Police Department. Before we get started, please check out my Amazon author page, where you'll find my series of behind-the-scenes NYPD books. They make great $10 Christmas gifts and $2.99 ebook downloads, including the NYPD's Flying Circus, Cops Crime, and Chaos. On today's episode, we're joined by Secret Service agent and author of the best-selling book, Fence Jumper, Mark Brandenburg. Hi, Mark, and welcome to the show.
Hey, Vic, good to be here. Thanks for having me on. Look forward to talking to you, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, thank you. The pleasure is mine. Mark, please tell our listeners a little about yourself and your field of expertise in law enforcement.
So my law enforcement career began in 1996. I was a police officer at the Olathe, Kansas Police Department, which is a suburb of Kansas City. So I graduated college. I grew up in Texas, but I graduated college near Kansas City, became a police officer at the suburb of Olathe, Kansas. From 96 to 01, I was a police officer there. So I was a street cop, an FTO for a time, and very shortly before leaving the department, I was also on the tactical support team, which is like our version of the SWAT team. Much larger police department now than when I was there, but in 2001, I was hired by the U.S. Secret Service agent as a U.S. Secret Service agent and moved to Chicago. So, you know, it was interesting because I always wanted to be a federal agent when I first started my law enforcement career. We did some search warrants for the Secret Service guys, and it's really funny how it happened. It was at that point, the Secret Service was still part of the Treasury Department. This is obviously pre-9/11. So we did some search warrants for them. I met the guys. They were all former cops, really good guys, and I just liked them is basically how it happened. Of course, I knew about the Secret Service. I was aware of what they did. Of course, everybody thinks about them. They think about protection and, you know, cool, you know, badass Ray-Ban sunglasses and walking along the limo and all that shit. So that's how your image of them is. But then you get to know them and you knew they were good guys. So anyway, I get hired by the Secret Service. I start the Chicago field office, was there 7 years. Coincidentally, my second day of training at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center was 9/11. It was a Tuesday. That was my second day of training down in Georgia. 7 years at Chicago. I was from 2008 to about 2014. I was on the presidential. I've been in Washington now 15 years, and I was a supervisory agent on the Vice Presidential Protective Division for almost 2 years with Mike Pence. Now I currently. I do mostly at this point in my career. I've been on 22 years now, obviously, with the service, and now I do a lot of protection for foreign dignitaries. So a lot of the stuff I do is people aren't aware of it, but like, you know, we were talking before we recorded, the United Nations, obviously being a New Yorker, is a big part of what we do is when foreign dignitaries, you know, prime ministers, presidents, other heads of state come to the United States, we protect them. So I do a lot of that now. So that's kind of a quick synopsis of kind of my career, if you will. But the, yeah, 15 years now, I've been doing directly, almost exclusively protection. So a lot of protection history there. And it's been an interesting career. And one of the great things about this job is we work with a lot of cops all over the country. So I've literally worked with police officers of every stripe. I'm not sure how many states I've missed, but it hasn't been many. I'll put it this way. Of the 50 states, I've worked with probably 40-plus different states. I've been protecting presidents and vice presidents, so I've worked with a lot of cops.
You know, I didn't even think of this question until you told me when you became a cop in the suburb of Kansas City. You were a police officer during the time the BTK killer was running around.
Yeah, and of course, I was probably too young. Yeah, it was. So it's interesting, you know, a suburban cop, you know, what's funny about. Yeah, it was during that time. Yeah, you're right. And of course, I don't think it came. I can't remember exactly when that came to light. But I remember when that came to become when I hit the news and that became a thing. We were like, holy crap. It was, you know, anytime you see something like that, cause it's always like out of nowhere. You're like, whoa, you don't realize. It really does remind you as a police officer or in law enforcement, you never know who you're running into. It's like whoever you're pulling over, that guy could be the next story that's on Dateline or some other show like that. You know, it's like it's wild when you hear about that. And you start wondering, as like, have I ever run across this person before? You know.
You know what it is with him? I think he started in the 70s, went into the 80s, then he went dormant for a while.
And yeah, that's right.
I think there was another serial killer or two got more attention than he got, and then he started up again. And then
It was one of those where, when it came to light, it's like more and more stuff started. You know, it's like one of those things that's like, you wonder too. I always think about this. Maybe this is a little morbid, but I always wonder. It's like, who have we not heard of? You know, because you know stuff like that kind of goes on, and I'm always like the guys you learn about. You're like, holy shit, that happened, and you're like, and of course, maybe it's the writer side of me is, or some side of me is like, good lord, there's got to be, because a lot of these guys seek attention, but this guy was unusual because he seemed not to, like he seemed like he didn't want anybody to know about it. So yeah, very very gross.
For a while, and then it looked like he wanted accolades, and that's when he started sending letters and leaving little clues.
That's right.
That was his downfall, because he needed it, and he got it because they ultimately caught him.
Yeah, it's interesting how that happens with those type of those really strange cases where part of it is a need for people to know about, well, hey, this is what I did, which obviously, you know, when you think about you know, movies or books that are written about it, that's why people, I think, are so fascinated by it. It's like that part of these people that wants people to know, as gruesome and horrible as what they did, they have some need or some insatiable desire to let people know about it. And that's just crazy.
Yeah, nobody I would hang out with. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, for sure.
To my knowledge, like you said, how many people haven't gotten caught and gotten away with it?
Oh, yeah, it's crazy.
So what was the training like to become a Secret Service agent?
So when you first get hired by the U.S. Secret Service, we have, it's about 6 months of training. So you go down to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center down in Glencoe, Georgia. And like I said, my second day there was 9/11. I tell young agents that now, because now I'm almost 50 years old. I talk to agents now who are like 20. Oh, I'm the old man at this point. So it's funny because I always like to tell, like, I'll work with these young agents. They'll be 26, 27. So at the time, they don't even remember 9/11. So I'll tell them about that, and usually the jaw drops to the floor. But anyway, you do about 3 months there. That's down in FLETC. It's basically a general police academy. So if you were a cop like yourself, it'd be like a review. And for me, I had been a cop for 5 years. It was like a review. It wasn't that hard. But for some, you know, obviously you get hired, people get hired who have no law enforcement background. Maybe they come from the military or other types of employment. So, but then you go from there, you go up to Washington, D.C. In Maryland, we have our training center, the Rally we call RTC, Rally Training Center, named after an old director of ours. And that's where we do a lot more protection and stuff specific to the Secret Service. And that obviously is new to me when I go up to that part of the training. So 6 months you do that, you start off in your field office, you're doing investigations. Back in the day, a lot of, you know, we got started doing financial crimes, and we still do counterfeiting, but mostly nowadays there's a lot of identity theft, mortgage fraud, all kinds of different types of fraud that we do at the federal level. So you do that, and then you go on to your phase two. That's phase one, and phase two is when you do your protection assignment, and that could be the president's detail, like I did. It could be the vice president's detail, or it could be like a former president. Like a lot of guys went down to Bush, down to nowadays Trump. Obviously, we have a detail down in Florida. Then you go to phase three, and your career kind of progresses from there. But you're definitely going to do, obviously, the bulk of what we do is protection, but we still do investigations. And, you know, there's a lot of crossover, too, in our investigations of what, like, say, the FBI does. But obviously, as you know, the headlines, that what we're known for and the thing that's going to put us in the newspaper is always protection, because that's the bulk of what we do.
I was watching a documentary about the Secret Service, and I couldn't believe the maneuvers they were doing with those presidential limousines. I couldn't believe it. Like, that's the track they have, and you've got a limousine going in reverse like 80 miles an hour. And I'm like, Yeah. Like, I thought I was a good driver. I was a detective in auto crime. I was in car chases all the time. Man, I would have loved that training.
Oh, the training is fun. So I was a transportation guy. So I was actually on the – when I was on – there was about 2 years on the president's detail. I was part of transportation where I drove the president of the United States. And that's what you're talking about, the J-turn. That's always very dramatic because it's like – they call it a J-turn because you pull that thing in reverse and you slam the brakes and you spin that thing around and you just basically use the dynamics of the car, all the weight obviously in these cars in the front where the engine is, and you can swing that thing around. The whole idea being if you had to pull it back and it's, you know, for egress purposes. But from just a guy perspective or just from a law enforcement perspective, it's a whole hell of a lot of fun to do the training. I'll tell you what, the training for the transportation section is very dynamic. It's very challenging. And it's also, the 8-year-old you comes out because you're out there. It's like, let's push this damn thing as hard as we can go.
the presidential limousine, I think it's called the Beast.
Yeah, they nicknamed, that's what it's been nicknamed for years is the Beast. Yep.
And it's a stylish tank. Can you tell us anything about it that's not classified?
There's not much I can say. I will say, here's what I will say is what they have nowadays, because it's gone through many iterations. Obviously, we have very good engineers. And, I remember, I'll put it this way. The earlier versions of it compared to now, it's a much easier vehicle to drive. It's much more user friendly. Over the years, they've made it where, you got to think about it. What people don't realize is when you have a vehicle with armor and all kinds of, there's all kinds of different, it's not like driving your own car. The dynamics, the physical dynamics are different. Visually it's going to be different. And that's what strikes people when they see it. They don't realize how different it is to drive a vehicle like that as opposed to something else. Even like talk about the United Nations, just like say an armored Suburban, it's just a different dynamic than say if you're driving your personal car just because of the weight and distribution and stuff. But I will say they've done a great job with it, and the vehicles they have now, they'll always make improvements to it, but I'll tell you what, they've done a really, really amazing job at the improvements they've made over the 20 years I've been there. And it's one of those things that's kind of under, people don't think about it. It's like the guys that are designing these things and making these, we get the Secret Service agents get the praise. We get to be cool and everybody gets to see us. But there's a lot of people behind the scenes. Those are one of them. Those unsung heroes of the engineers, the people who are behind the scenes who are coming up with these ideas and putting them into action. And we get to play with them. We get to have the fun with them. But those are the guys but they've done an amazing job over the years. It's, that's what's really fascinating to me about in 20 years of doing this, to see if I took a vehicle that we drove 20 years ago and a vehicle we drove now, what they have nowadays is just so much better than what we had, just 20 years ago.
And part of your training, obviously you had a lot of firearms training. Can you say what kind of weapons you were trained on?
Yeah. So when I first started, it used to be like MP5s and shotguns, we had a Sig Sauer 357, caliber, and now we've transitioned to Glocks now as far as our sidearms are concerned. Also, we have firearms wise, I'm not going to go into the details of what we have. We've upgraded. I'll put it that way. What we have now is, because obviously you have to match, just like in a street cop or any law enforcement organization, you got to match whatever is out there. And obviously when you see, unfortunately, we've had this spate of school shootings and other shootings and stuff. And so you realize all the weaponry that's out there, and you have to match that, because obviously if it can be used in random acts of violence, it could also be used against a protectee. So we've upgraded our weapon systems over the last several years to match basically what the type of things we expect to find out there if we were to come across a person that's going to try to harm the president or the vice president. So I'll leave it at that. But that gives you a general sense. I think that's across law enforcement. I think we've seen that. You can look nowadays, anytime you see an incident on the news, you see what the local PDs have compared to what they had, say, 30, 40 years ago. And it's night and day. I mean, you remember back in the day, we were still having, we had, it wasn't long before I got here. We still had wheel guns. So everything's been upgraded.
I had a 38. Yeah. And my class was the first class that had speed loaders. So before speed loaders, we had dump pouches. It was this little pouch and it was like pulling good and plenties out.
Yeah.
Manually stick the bullets in the cylinder. Yeah. So, and then probably about 95, the NYPD switched over to the 9mm.
Yeah. And that's pretty common. You know, I found even my old police department, I started in 96, and it wasn't only a few years before that that they still had revolvers as well. And now it's funny because my generation, if I try to shoot a revolver, it feels strange as hell to me. But the old timers, the guys that started with them, they swear by them because, you know, you could bury a revolver for about 400 years, pull it out of the ground, and it's still going to shoot.
It's true. A lot of the old timers that were retiring wanted nothing to do with the 9mm. Like, say, listen, you're going for training. And the guy would go, I'm retiring in a year. I don't want this thing. Like, what are you kidding?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was 7 or 8 years on the job. I was like, yeah, I'll do it. Send me.
Yeah, exactly.
After your training now, you got sent to the Chicago field office. What was that like and what kind of cases were you working on?
So I was in the the time I was there, I did financial crimes. And also I was on a task force with that included the Illinois State Police, Chicago Police. But most of the stuff we did was fraud. Everything from identity theft. We had, you know, even back then in the 90s, you had, or in the early 2000s, you had, you know, we caught, you know, different scams and fraud, lots of mortgage fraud at the time too. So there was all, that's basically what we did. You know, people, even back then you would have people in banks or other places that would steal people's identity or, you know, somehow siphon funds from, different entities. And so that's mostly what we did. And so, you know, the good thing about being a street cop and then going to the feds is if by the time we interviewed somebody at the federal level, you usually have you got the goods on them pretty good. Like you have a lot of information. Whereas, you know, as a street cop, you show up to a call and you're like, you don't know what the hell is going on. You're just trying to figure it out. And really those skills that I learned as a young person, as a street cop, were awesome. By the time I got to the federal, it seemed easy because I was like, well, shit. I come here, I have all this information on this guy. I know everything about this dude. I know who his mom is. I know who his girlfriend is. I know his bank records. I know everything about this guy. So you just let them talk, and they usually will bury themselves. We did a lot of that. It was a lot of fun. But even that's called phase one of our career. Even then, you're doing a lot of – I remember going on airplanes and going down to Crawford, Texas. This is back during the Bush years. And I'm standing out in the middle of a field in Crawford, Texas at 2 a.m. So you're still doing protection, even when you're doing protection never goes away for the U.S. Secret Service. It's always looming. Even when you're doing investigations, you're going to go, you tell your the U.S. attorney, hey, I'm going to be gone next week because I'm going to be down wherever. I'm going to be out in Boise because the president's going there or something. So you never know when that's going to get pulled. So
Secret Service has a rich history going after counterfeiters. Now, I know the world has changed over the last 25 years, that things have moved to plastic, and now it's more skimming and siphoning funds, like you said earlier, out of people's accounts. But did you ever work on a counterfeiting case or have counterfeiting training?
We did. And I don't know. And like I said, I've been far removed from the investigative side for a while, but obviously counterfeiting is never going away. You know, for people who don't know, in 1865, right after the Civil War, they created the Secret Service because counterfeiting was terrible, especially in the South. There was all kinds of counterfeiting going on. And so that's how we got the cool name. Because we literally were United States Secret Service. It was like we were operatives. They were literally undercover. And that's where the name came from. It wasn't until 1901, after McKinley was assassinated, that we started protecting presidents. And the first president was Teddy Roosevelt, because he was vice president, became president because McKinley was shot and killed. So anyway, that's how we got the cool name, and that's where counterfeiting is still a thing, but now you got crypto, you got all kinds of things. You still have scams, you know, overseas scams and those type of things going on all the time. So I don't think that as far as counterfeiting is concerned, it's not the issue it was obviously back in the day, but it's still a thing. I mean, you still have to protect physical currency. So it's not gone completely, but it's certainly not what it was, you know, 100 years ago for sure.
I remember reading at one point that our adversaries like Iran and North Korea were linked to counterfeiting, like state sponsored.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about that too. Like I said, I'm not aware of it, but yes, there is a lot of, and obviously, if you have foreign entities that have more sophisticated operations, because I remember, back in the day, let's say 20 years ago in Chicago when I started, I mean, you would have some of it was almost laughable how bad people would try to do, you know, because obviously you've got Xeroxes, people would do all these type of things, and what people don't realize is how. One of the cool things is when you get hired, we actually go to a Bureau of Engraving and Printing, and we actually see how the money's made. Oh, it's kind of fascinating. Cool. It's very cool, and I think citizens, like regular folks, can get tours of that. And if you're ever in D.C. and get a chance to go to the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, it really is worth going because it is fascinating. There's a lot that goes into it. So I would just say to people out there who've thought about maybe counterfeiting, I would not do it. It's really a bad idea because it's really, really hard to do, and it's really easy. It's the super easiest thing in the world to detect is a counterfeiter. So.
Oh, definitely. And which leads me to the 1985 film To Live and Die in L.A. And the movie is about a counterfeiter. Yeah. And the opening scene of the movie, they show this guy working in this press with the engravings and burning out these plates and then running the cash off. You've seen the movie. How accurate was that scene to what was going on back then?
Yeah. Well, so in the movie, obviously being a movie, I think that it's been a while since I've seen it, but I remember, they did a pretty good job, a really good job actually in the movie of making it look like a very sophisticated counterfeiter, how that would work. Now, in reality, the counterfeiters that were going on weren't nearly as sophisticated as they are in the movie. I mean, you had people like that. I know there's, I can't remember the case, but there's, I remember reading about cases back in the day where you had very sophisticated counterfeiters where they made currency that looked very, very much like what the actual currency looks like. And there's all kinds of systems and things in the currency to detect that. But they were actually really good in that movie of showing like a really sophisticated work, because I know there's been cases in the past, like I said, these are rare, where they had people who were that sophisticated, who had the full you can imagine the amount of machine that you would need to create currency that realistic was pretty extensive. And that's why most counterfeiters are not that elevated when it comes to making counterfeit. It's usually pretty easy to detect. But yeah, they did a great job in that movie of kind of showing how, if somebody did it the right way, if somebody knew what they were doing, how they would go about doing it. So that was a fun movie.
Yeah, it was. And I watched a documentary about the film, and the director, William Friedkin, said he actually hired ex-counterfeiters to do that scene. And what wound up happening was they produced a bunch of funny money, or Play-Doh, as you guys call it. And some of the some of the people on the set took the money and passed the bills, and it got linked back to the movie set. So there was a lot of explaining to do. I don't know if anybody got arrested.
Oh, that's funny. But that's I wasn't aware of that.
I watched a documentary, and he was going on about that, how, you know, he said they were filming this thing out in the desert, and he said they were terrified that at any moment the Secret Service was going to come in and lock them up. And then some of the production assistants pocketed some of the bills, and you know how it goes. First they pocket it, and it's going to be a souvenir. Then the next thing you know, it gets mixed in with their money, and then they pass it in a bar, and you guys are pretty good at going reverse, finding out where that money came from. And, it came back to the set. I remember, because I did Dignitary Protection with the Secret Service quite a bit, and I remember talking to an agent about that, and this is years ago, and I remember him telling me that you guys used to usually have the jump on counterfeiters before they even produced a note, because there was a certain type of paper you had to buy, there were different inks, and people in the industry would tip off the Secret Service and go, this guy just bought, enough paper, to start his own bank, or this guy just bought enough ink, and the type of ink would be to make, money. Yeah. So they said that you guys had a good working relationship with people in the printing industry.
That's probably true. Yeah, I'm sure that obviously predated when I was on, but I had no doubt back in the, I can imagine in like the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that that kind of thing was much more prevalent and much more, especially, you know, when cash was used way more frequently than it is nowadays. I bet that was the case.
And you worked on a lot of credit card cases. What was like the most common scam that you saw?
Oh boy. The most common, this is, like I said, this, back in the day, if you talk to like an agent now in their first phase who are doing a lot more investigations, they would have a lot more on this. But like, you know, a lot of identity theft, a lot of that was involved. And we had everything. I remember having cases that were, it wasn't unusual to have somebody who maybe worked at the bank who had a connection to somebody else, you know, get information. Somebody that worked at the bank or worked somewhere else would get information and pass it to somebody. And they would use that to basically identity theft. They would use that to start buying all kinds of stuff. And they may sell the things they're buying. But that was very common back in the day. And then mortgage fraud was the other one. You would have one of the things that we saw, I remember in Chicago, was somebody would have somebody, and sometimes the people who would do the appraisals were involved. And so they would appraise something for much higher than it was actually worth. They would somehow finagle a mortgage. And they would take the money and run. So there was a lot that was before I left Chicago. That became very popular, particularly this was like 2007, 2008, right before the bubble burst. So remember at that time, how cost of real estate went way up. There was like this huge bubble because it was really easy to get lending. It was really easy to get that money. So back then there were people just defrauding these companies left and right because it was easy money. You know, you appraise something for way more than it's worth, get the mortgage or get whatever loan you were going to get, and then you just take the money and run. So that was very common back in the day. I don't know how common it is now, but those type of schemes, I'm sure, are still going on.
It probably still goes on, but not to the way it was back then.
Yeah, it was a very – and that was the perfect timing. Like, see, thinking we're not going to be here that long. Well, before you know it, we're here 15 years later. But the it was a big change. But it's really the most exciting part of your career because it's funny because you're a suburban cop, you're just a regular Joe. Next thing you know, you're driving to the White House for work. So it's a little bit of a surreal experience.
It's cool.
it's very cool. But I joke about it sometimes because like the first few days, you're like, you feel like you're an imposter. Like, am I allowed to do this? Can I walk over here? Can I do this? So it's a very exciting part of, I think, every agent's career. But it's also kind of surreal because, you know, the places you find yourself on this job can be kind of surprising.
So me having previously worked with the New York City Police Department, I know how it works in New York City when the president comes to town. So usually what happens with us, right? I worked in organized crime. A day or two before we know the president's coming into town, right? We get a notification and they'll tell, like, say my office had 120 detectives in auto crime. They would take 30 of us. So there'd be a detail roster. Okay, tomorrow you're going to report down Park Avenue and 40-something street. And there'd be guys there from the narcotics division. I mean, the NYPD has 40,000 members. So when the president comes to town, I mean, it's a monumental task. And they shut down that area. And usually where the president stays is the Waldorf Astoria. And I was always, having worked the perimeter at the Waldorf many times in uniform, I was always amazed at that caravan of vehicles that you guys are in that gets into that basement of that building so quick. It's the most, and no one really can see this because everything is blocked. That street is shut down. When that guy's coming down, no one's getting on that block. And I was always fascinated how that caravan of vehicles, and I don't know how many, I'm not going to say, but just they get into that basement and the door goes down. It's like a magic trick.
Yeah, there's a lot of planning, a lot of coordination goes into it. And I know exactly what you're talking about because I've driven cars into that very garage and it's tight. You know, you got these big vehicles and it's really tight. It's not small. A lot goes into that. But yeah, I mean, every time you go up to New York, and that's what's amazing, people realize too, is how dependent we are on like New York Police Department or the local police. I remember doing when I was in New York, because you guys ruled the roost there. I remember running routes. We would run routes at like 2 a.m. because it's the only time you could get around New York City is, you know, in the middle of the night because the traffic's so bad there. But I remember leaning on those guys, and the traffic cops and all the guys that worked NYPD during these events were They made us, I'll put it this way, NYPD made us look really good. Like, we did our part good, but the NYPD was always, is held in very high regard by the U.S. Secret Service because they always knock it out of the park.
Well, our highway guys, those are the guys that patrol our parkways and conduct vehicle accidents and stuff. Those guys are the best. They do what's called a rolling roadblock. So motorcycle cop will pull up to one intersection and block it off. The whole thing goes by. He gets on the back end, and they just keep switching up, shutting down the street.
Well, exactly. And they know the city. They got it down to a science. So, you know, to a degree, it's like we lean on those guys. I remember one time President Obama did a fundraiser at a place. I want to say it was in the southern part of Manhattan. Anyway, we leave this place. We're heading to the LZ where the helicopter, the Marine One, you know, he would do his lifts. Well, somehow one of the vans, I think it was like a staffer van or something like that, got left behind. And of course, you know, people are panicking. And so, and I'm like, I told the NYPD guy, I go, and these guys, here's how badass they are. Somehow they got on the radio and they got like three bikes and they got that thing. You never knew there was a problem. We got to the LZ, we got to the helicopter. And that van, next thing we know, we see that van showing up with three or four bike cops who somehow found them and got them there. And I'm just like, I just remember going to the NYPD officer in charge and saying, "You guys are fucking magic, man. I don't know how y'all did it." Because we would have probably, my guess is, if they didn't get the van there, we'd probably have to wait for them because there were some really important people in that particular vehicle. So anyway, that tells you how good. How much we respect and how much we really need the NYPD whenever we show up in their town.
It's funny because I did my first dignitary protection thing and I had never worked with the Secret Service before, so I really didn't know what to expect. And you work with different agencies and you hear different things, and I loved you guys. Like, I thought you guys were professional, down to earth. I always got a kick out of working you guys. Another thing I always got a kick out of, when the presidential caravan goes by, that last Suburban is got the back window down, and there's a guy sitting like he's strapped in a fishing chair, like he's going for marlin, and he's sitting there with a machine gun in his lap, and I'm like, I thought we were badass, like these guys are the real deal.
Yeah, people love to see the people are fascinated. You know, it's funny when you do this job is, and you see it as a cop to a degree, but like it's funny because people get very excited, and they see that stuff, and they're like, "Holy crap!" And look, I'd be lying if I said, I guarantee you the guy sitting back there with his rifle or whatever he probably felt pretty badass too. Cause it's like, you know, you're in the middle of the bubble and it's pretty damn fun.
There's not that many people that are going to get the opportunity to do that in this, you know, in this world or this lifetime.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. And that's why you do all the training and that's why you do all that. Go ahead.
Yeah, you were also a member of the transportation section that drives the president and conducts transportation advances. What are the challenges and how does that work?
Well, I mean, as you can imagine, I can only say so much, but I think the challenges are what you would expect them to be. And once again, this is where working with the local police department is invaluable. Because if I show up to say Milwaukee, I'm not from Milwaukee. I'm trusting the cops there to give me information. And so we're getting all kinds of information from them. And what's great about the police in our country, besides the fact that they put themselves on the line, is when we show up, they bring everything they can to help us out. And so we have great working relationships all over the country. But imagine if you have the president of the United States, I got to get him from point A to point B. And just imagine all the myriad things that could be in the way. You got everything from bridges, things underneath the road, you got trains, you got all kinds of different issues to concern yourself with, and how you're going to mitigate that to make it as safe as possible to transport them from point A to point B. And imagine that your protectee is going to three or four sites. Now you just complicated it even more. And at the same time, and New York, this is very particular. You want to shut down the roads, but at the same time, you shut down the roads too early. Guess what? The mayor of New York City is going to be pissed off. So a lot of times the cops are like, "Hey, we're going to shut this." You're trying to do that without also just shutting down the entire city. You know, you've got to be able to work with the police so you can provide a safe environment, but at the same time, you know, people have lives and jobs to do, and you can't just shut down the city. This is a we live in a democracy. This is not so we need people to be able to live their lives. So it's like it's trying to balance all that, and I think that's what people don't realize sometimes is when we're planning this stuff, you're trying to figure out what's the balance. You know, protect the president, but at the same time, be responsive to the city and the citizens of that city. You, like I said, you can't just shut the place down for a day. It's gonna. So you have a lot of things that are weighing in when you're doing that. But yeah, that gives you a kind of a sense of what we're dealing with when you're dealing with a motorcade advance type situation. Like I said, driving the car is easy. The hard part really is planning. It's all the planning that goes into it that's the hard part of the job.
Has the president ever told you, we're running late, step on it?
No, he hasn't. But no, it's funny because the good thing about being president, I think, is everybody's waiting on you. So so you don't have to worry. It's like you don't have to worry about being late or being early. But it is funny. And their schedules. And that's the other thing is a lot of times, you know, with the president, vice president and people like that, you know, they have very tight schedules. Typically, it's pretty well planned out. But at the same that. It is kind of funny. Usually if we're running late. It's usually some staffer you'll find sweating more than anybody else. There's some staffer who's planning this all out, who's sweating bullets about it. So
when you guys go overseas, all those vehicles and equipment are loaded into cargo planes, right?
Yeah.
And they go to whatever country. Are you involved in that at all?
We are. So, obviously the Air Force helps us. That's the other thing people don't realize is the military has a lot of a big responsibility in what we do as far as transportation and things like that. If we go overseas, all that stuff's transported with us. I mean, you think about all the things, everything from canines to equipment to everything you can imagine we're bringing with us. So, you know, there's a lot of, the one thing I've learned over the years that America does really, really well is logistics, better than any other country on the planet. If you look at our military or you look at how we operate, really, the thing we do better than any. There's a reason why FedEx and UPS and Amazon were created in America. We're really, really good at logistics, and that's what. And our military is shows you that all the time. Like every time we do something overseas or anything in the States, we work along with them and plan that stuff out, and it's seamless. And you don't realize it until you go to other countries and realize what a shit show it could be in other countries, because some countries just can't figure it out. They cannot figure out how to get people, equipment, and stuff where it needs to be at the time it needs to be there. You'd be shocked how bad it can be at some places. So,
have you ever flown on Air Force One?
Several times. Number of times, yeah. I've been on Air Force One. I've been on Marine One. I've been on Air Force Two, the vice president's plane. It's once again, going back to telling you about when you're a new agent to protection, that kind of sense you have when you first start going to the White House, it's the same thing with Air Force One. It never gets old. Anybody that goes on that plane, whether you're a journalist or a staffer or a Secret Service agent, even the president, I don't think it ever gets old for people. I think everybody always has an appreciation for it because it's such an iconic part of our culture. It never gets old. So yeah, it's one of those honors, and it's one of the reasons why people like myself became Secret Service agents is to do something like that. So yeah, once again, what's kind of cool too is you get this really nice the first time you fly on Air Force One, they give you a nice it's like a plaque type thing, and it's signed by the pilot who flew you. It's very cool. So I go in the basement right now. I have a certificate from Marine One, a certificate from Air Force One, and it's signed by the pilot who flew you. So it's a special thing, and it's not lost. I don't think it's lost on anybody. I think everybody that does that, has the opportunity to do it, cherishes that part of the job and that part of the experience.
Is it true that there's unlimited pretzels on Air Force One?
There's certainly unlimited M&Ms. One of the most popular things is they have red, white, and blue M&Ms. if you go to the White House, you can get a box of red, white, and blue M&Ms. So if you ever go to the White House, make sure that you ask whoever's there. It's like, hey, I want my box of M&Ms, and they should have a box of M&Ms somewhere.
You're going to start a run on M&Ms at the White House.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. M&M stock just went up.
So we touched upon earlier about the great working relationship that you have with the NYPD and other police departments around the country. How does that differ with your counterparts in other countries? Is it just as smooth? I know you touched upon that the logistics isn't
When you're working with other countries, because other cultures, languages, you know, it's some places it's easier than others. You go to some countries, and you know, obviously, you know, it's a weird circumstance because you're in a different country. So it's, you know, we're not sovereign there. You know, once I go to Belgium or something, I'm no longer a police officer there. Really, I don't have any standing. But you're working in conjunction with them, so it becomes very much a, you know, State Department's involved, a lot of other diplomatic things are involved. But yeah, I think all in all, the experience that I had in other countries has been really positive. It's just a whole different thing. And also, so we take long, obviously those type of advances take much longer because there's so many things that come into it. But, you know, they have a vested interest in this going well. But it's interesting. The things you'll come around, because sometimes, I guess the best example is sometimes they'll have an idea of what they want to do when we show up, of how they want the cars to be arranged or how they want the motorcade or however things are done. And it might be completely different than what we want. And so now you have to work that out and figure out how we're going to do this so everybody's happy and it doesn't compromise security. Obviously, security is of the utmost. But yes, I can think of – I've done advances in Tanzania, Poland, El Salvador, Singapore, Ghana. I mean, you all these different countries, no matter what. So all these different countries all have, not one of them is the same. And you're going to come across obstacles and issues, and you got to be diplomatic and work it out at the same time, maintain security. So it's I'll put it this way. By the time you get home after one of those trips, going to sleep is really easy. You're very tired because it's usually a pretty difficult task. But it also is some of the most rewarding work you'll do because, working with these other countries and bring, obviously, anytime the president of the United States goes to a different country, you know, it's a big deal. So there's a lot that goes into it. And that's what's interesting. You know, recently the president was overseas, and I always think about those young agents who are doing the work. It's like people don't think about that. They've been over there for weeks and weeks at a time, working their asses off, 16-hour days. And, you know, the president, you'll see him on TV for about an hour, you know, half an hour, and all the work that goes into that. I think about those guys a lot. Every time I see an overseas trip, I think about those people. A lot of work goes into it, for sure.
Yeah, that goes to show you that movie In the Line of Fire with Clint Eastwood. I mean, no guy 60-something years old is going to be working 16-hour days, not sleeping in his own bed, and then running alongside of a presidential motorcade. It's just funny. I saw that, like, because I had that dignitary protection. I know what you guys, the amount of hours and travel and jet lag that you guys got to deal with, and I'm like, oh, come on.
I know. What's funny is it's a great movie. I was in high school. I can still remember watching that movie when I was in high school. And of course, Clint Eastwood, so he's badass. But it's funny now to look back on it. Yeah, and it's funny to look back on it now because now if I'm – like the other day or last week even, I was on my feet for, you know, 15 hours. You know, I'm almost 50 years old. I'm like, Clint Eastwood in that movie has to be in his mid-50s at least. I go, you're exhausted by the end of the day. A great movie. But, yeah, you're right. It certainly helps. You know, like when I see those young agents out there, it certainly helps to have those young, new feet because you're on your feet a lot. It can be pretty exhausting.
Yeah, well, law enforcement's a young man's game. That's what people don't realize.
Oh, for sure.
We were talking about different security details and stuff. I once, you know, we worked with different ones that came into the United States. And one time, my partner and I were were tasked with guarding Benjamin Netanyahu. He was no longer prime minister. He was out, but I think he was trying to get back in. So he came to the United States with two of his guys from the Shin Bet. And these guys were commandos in suits.
Yeah.
Like, these guys were badass. And we're talking to them. Like, he's having his lunch in this, you know, Manhattan restaurant. And these guys are telling us that before they joined the Shin Bet, they were in the Israeli army and they were knocking over terrorist houses in the West Bank in tanks. And I'm like, wow, I feel like a pussy. Like, hearing these guys.
I know. No. Yeah, those guys are badass. And, well, you're in Israel, you have to serve the military. And the Shin Bet guys, of course, imagine if New Jersey was full of people that wanted to kill you. That's basically what they're dealing with every day. So, the world they come from, they are battle tested. They are not guys you want to mess with.
They'll be young, but, like, no joke. I remember, I didn't want to be like a kid around them. And then after, you know, later on, my partner and I looking at each other like, what just happened? Like, we were just hanging out with, like, two really badass guys, man.
Yeah, you can imagine what those guys have seen.
No doubt. Serving as the supervisory agent on Vice President Mike Pence's detail, what was that like?
It was great. It was actually one of the better experiences of my career. I was like a shift leader, so I had like a group of agents. And so the guys you would see around the Vice President, I would be in charge of the group around them. And so you're kind of the quarterback. It's a ton of work, but it's very rewarding work. And a lot of the people what's funny is, and I was lucky because I had a good group of people. So I'm still tight, close friends with them. I'm sure you've had this experience at NYPD where sometimes you'll have that point in your career where you just get a good group of guys and gals and you're lifelong friends. And that's kind of how I was. I'm still friends with these guys. Most of them are still in the job and you're trying to help each other out and if they need something, they can shoot me a text or something. So it was a lot of fun. Like I said, it's a lot of work because I'm doing schedules. I'm getting guys in training. I'm, giving people assignments, but you're also getting briefings and stuff for protection assignments and stuff. So it's a constant thing. It's one of those jobs where you're on vacation down on the beach and you have your work computer is always handy because you're always on the job when you're doing something like that. So, but it was very rewarding. One of the best parts of my career for sure.
I mean, during your time protecting the president and the vice president, have you ever had somebody when you're doing, the detail, have someone like make the hair on your neck stand up in a crowd?
I think what you have is you notice, so you're super, one of, and to my wife's chagrin, we're very observant. You don't even realize how observant you are. You pick up stuff that your people aren't aware of. Like if I go to an airport, I'm picking up stuff all the time. I can easily pick out any of the federal air marshals, anybody else, whether I'm traveling with my family or whatever. So you're very observant. So, because it becomes ingrained in you so much because you're doing it so often, but yeah, you've had people. What's funny is, how often you've had people that maybe seemed out of the ordinary. And you might make it aware to your other colleagues, hey, keep an eye on so-and-so or hey, the guy in this, maybe something like that happens pretty frequently. And a lot of times he might just be a fucking weirdo. It's like he may not even be harmful. It's funny because you don't know. Sometimes you'll wonder afterward, is there a concern there? Because you're always looking for that thing, that's something that's kind of out of the ordinary. But so, yeah, you've had those moments. And sometimes more frequently, I would say, is you have people like with Trump, there was a lot of enthusiasm. With Obama, there was a lot of enthusiasm for those particular politicians in my time. And so there was sometimes where people, they didn't want to do them any harm, but they were just so excited to see them. They were about to jump over the fence. They were about to jump a fence because it was almost like Beatlemania. I mean, I had that happen with Obama before. And the lady, this woman was not a threat, but she was, I thought she was going to jump over the fence. I go, ma'am, you got to stay where you're at. So you see that too. You see both the people who are out of the ordinary who might be a concern. And then you also see people who are just super excited about seeing this person, and they lose their minds. And so sometimes you gotta kind of shake them up. You gotta, or at least get their attention and go, "Hey, you can't go past this point. You got to stay there. So well, you see a little bit of everything.
And if they're super, and if they're super focused on something, you kind of want to tap into that and kind of see if you could misdirect that energy to see what is this person really about.
Do they panic? Exactly.
Are they just, like you said, are they just nuts, or do they have a mission?
Yeah. Well, no, and that's where, and just like a police officer, a street police officer, you want to. It's best to engage people, because, like, if you're a street cop, if you engage somebody, you can kind of get a sense of where they're coming from. And also, like with the person who's like the super fan, let's say Trump, there's a super fan, they're super excited to see him. Sometimes just then suddenly a Secret Service person's in your face going, "Hey, brother, just you need to settle down," or "Hey, just stay where, you know, don't cross, you can't come past this point." And sometimes you can see the for a second, you can see that recognition in their eyes, like, oh, you know, they were just super excited and adrenaline took the best of them. And sometimes it's just engaging them and they'll be like, oh, okay, I got you. And, you know, they're good people. They're not trying to do anything wrong. And then immediately you see them kind of realize, okay, I'll stay where I was told by the cop, or I was told by the agent to stay put. And sometimes something as simple as that can be, can kind of bring them back to reality, if you will. So
yeah, you kind of break them up from whatever they were thinking of doing, which leads me to your book. You're an author now.
Yeah.
And you've written this great book called Fence Jumper. Tell us about it.
Well, Fence Jumper, so it's funny. It was vetted by the U.S. Secret Service, because it was published in February of 2023. It's, so I call it a humorous political thriller. It's the feedback's been fantastic, and the sales have been really good. So what it's about is James Ford is a Secret Service agent. He's suspended for a sex scandal in South America. You may have heard of things that have happened like that in the past. And so a senator is running in the presidential primary, has his wife kidnapped, so he looks like a political victim. Well, James Ford, she escapes, he finds her, and they start investigating this kidnapping. And it kind of goes from there. For listeners, Carl Hiaasen is I'm a big fan of Carl Hiaasen novels. People who aren't aware, he writes kind of quirky, funny mystery novels set in Florida. I think he works for the Miami Herald, and so I kind of base my writing off of that. So it's very satirical. Actually, Hugh Hewitt, the radio host and Fox News contributor, read it, loved it. I was on his show. Former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien read it. He loved it. He put a tweet out. He called it Veep meets House of Cards, which I thought was a great description. So people have been really entertained by it. It's a thriller. It's a lot of fun, and it's funny, and people, it's a good page turner. It's a good escapist read. So it's called Fence Jumper. I think people, obviously, because of my career, I have a lot of insight into how things work in Washington. So I'll put it this way. If you follow politics, you enjoy politics, or following the occurrences in Washington, D.C., you're going to see a lot of that in this, and you're going to get a lot of laughs out of it. So, and you'll be entertained. It's a good thriller on top of it. I'm about 15,000 words into the next book with the same character. So, and it's tentatively called Webcam Girl. Webcam Girl. So it's also going to be a political thriller, satirical, with a lot of humor in it. It's going to have some people in there. Just like Fence Jumper, you'll see, like in Fence Jumper, there's the president tweets. He'll be familiar to people, and you'll see a lot of other people in there that I make fun of pretty much everything in Washington, D.C. So if you like that sort of thing, a Fence Jumper is a good read, and the feedback has been I couldn't be happier with the feedback.
Well, Mark, congratulations on your book, and where can my listeners pick up a copy?
Go on Amazon. If you start putting in Fence Jumper, that's the easiest place to get it. You can get it on a hardcover, a paperback, or Kindle. You can also get it at Barnes & Noble. I'm also going to be November 4th. I'm going to be at the Barnes & Noble in Fairfax. If anybody who's listening from DC area, around 11 a.m. on November 4th, which is a Saturday. So before kickoff, before the football games start, I'll be at the Fairfax Barnes & Noble at Fair Lakes. And I'm going to have some other appearances. But the I know the people in D.C., it's interesting. I've had several people who are in government and stuff, and the people in D.C. have really enjoyed it, because it's based in Washington, D.C., and it makes fun of this town about as good as anything I could think of recently, in a fun, even-handed way. Like, when you get done reading this, you won't know my political leanings at all. I did that on purpose. I made sure that people didn't know where I stood on politics, but they realized that we can make fun of this place, this crazy town, and have a good time doing it.
So to my listeners, pick up a copy of Mark Brandenburg's book, Fence Jumper. It's available on Amazon and where books are sold. Mark, I want to thank you for coming on my show. I really appreciate it. It means a lot to me.
Oh, Vic.
I also want to thank
Thanks,
everyone.
Vic. I really appreciate the invite.
The pleasure is mine, man. I really appreciate it, and I respect the service and everything you guys do. I'd also like to thank everyone for tuning in, especially my listeners in Louisville, Kentucky, Yonkers, New York, and Detroit, Michigan. If you work in law enforcement and would like to be a guest on my show, please drop me a note on Twitter or Instagram, at VicFerrari50. If you enjoyed the content, check out my Amazon author page, type in my name, Vic, Ferrari like the car, where you can preview all my books for free, including NYPD Law and Disorder. Thank you for tuning in, and I'll have another episode out next week.